Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Rightful Retirement of Georgia conference call. At this time, all participants are on the listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the call, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would like to introduce your host for today's call, Mrs. Amelia Shenstone. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Dorinda. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our telephone press conference to share the findings of a Union of Concerned Scientists report, Ripe for Retirement, the Case for Closing America's Costliest Coal Plants. My name is Amelia Shenstone, and I work with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy in our Atlanta office. Our first speaker this morning is Steve Frankel, a report co-author who manages programs aimed at addressing climate change and promoting clean energy solutions as the director of UCS's Midwest office. He'll be followed by Jeff Dayette, report co-author and assistant director of energy research for UCS's climate and energy program. Finally, we'll hear from Ula Reeves, who oversees the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy's high-risk energy program and manages state-based and regional coal campaigns highlighting public health and environmental concerns about coal pollution and water use. Steve and Jeff will share the report's findings, and then Ula will discuss the prospects for actually retiring coal-fired units in Georgia. After the speakers have made their opening remarks, the operator will give you instructions for how to ask a question. Steve, I'll now turn it over to you.
Thanks, Ula. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining our call. My name is Steve Frankel. I'm the director of UCS's Midwest office in Chicago, and I'm a co-author of the Right for Retirement report that we are releasing today. I'm going to start with some background, and I'll turn it over to Jeff to dig into the real nuts and bolts. In terms of context, as you all know, America's power sector is going through a period of unprecedented change. Our historic reliance on coal-fired power has been decreasing over the last few years as aging coal plants are being used less and less or being retired outright. Since 2008, we've seen the share of coal's portion of our electricity mix decrease from 50% to about 37%. At the same time, we've seen cleaner energy resources ramp up in their usage, with greater use of natural gas generation and increased investment in wind power. Driving these changes is a combination of both market forces and policy factors, such as low natural gas prices, rising coal costs, pollution standards, and the falling cost of renewable energy that's making it more cost competitive. Age is also a key factor in affecting the competitiveness of the coal fleet nationally. Many coal plants are old. 77% of the nation's coal fleet has already exceeded its originally expected 30-year life profitable operation. 17% began producing power in 1962 or earlier, making them at least 50 years old. These older coal generators typically lack modern pollution controls, like scrubbers for sulfur dioxide. And according to EPA, more than 80% of the nation's coal capacity generation that's older than 50 years old lacks this important pollution control technology. So compared with the entire U.S. coal fleet, the generators that are have been scheduled to retire so far, on average, are older, smaller, operate less frequently, and are dirtier than the rest of the coal fleet. As a result, they tend to not operate as much as newer, more efficient, better controlled coal generators. As a result of all these factors, utilities have already decided to shut down 41 gigawatts of coal generation over the next few years. These already announced retirements equal about 12% of the nation's coal fleet. Utilities have decided to close these older, less efficient coal plants because they've concluded that it doesn't make sense to keep them running or to keep investing in them. In other cases, they've decided to mothball the plant because they are uncompetitive in today's power market, where low-cost natural gas and flat demand have depressed power prices. I'd like to share a couple anecdotes with you about the economic risks that utilities face and their customers face if they decide to double down and continue to invest in old coal plants. In some cases, utilities have sunk millions of dollars, even hundreds of millions of dollars, in pollution control retrofits only to find that a plant is no longer profitable to operate. The first example I'd like to share is First Energy's W.H. Sammis plant in Ohio. It's S-A-M-M-I-S. Just this past August, First Energy announced that it would idle this 45-year-old Sammis plant The plant was constructed in 1959 through the 1971 as boilers were new generators were added to the plant. But just a few years ago, FirstEnergy decided to install new push controls and spent $1.8 billion doing so. And within 2 years of spending $1.8 billion to modernize the plant, they decided to shut that plant down. Now the plant will essentially operate only when it's needed on the highest energy demand days. So this idled plant, after spending $1.8 billion, is not going to operate frequently and will not be generating revenue on a regular basis. A similar situation can be found in New Hampshire, where Public Service of New Hampshire faced a similar choice, whether to clean up or shut down its 52-year-old Merrimack Station power plant. In 2009, the company chose to retrofit the plant and spent $422 million doing so, installing new pollution controls. But in February of this year, the company announced it would idle Merrimack Station because it costs utility more to run the plant than to buy electricity from cleaner-burning natural gas power plants nearby. So the utility's customers will be paying off these retrofits through their electricity bills for many years, even when the plant sits idle and doesn't run. That's because, like other regulated utilities across the country, Public Service of New Hampshire got approval from state regulators to raise its rates so they can pass the full cost of pollution controls onto the ratepayers and earn a return on that investment. So these are two cautionary examples of where utilities chose to invest in plants that can no longer compete and were effectively shuttered. So what about the rest of the coal fleet beyond these 41 gigawatts of coal plants that have already been slated for closure? We at UCS wanted to see what other economically vulnerable coal generation may be out there today. So we conducted an economic analysis aimed to see how the rest of the coal fleet could compete with cleaner, more efficient resources like combined cycle natural gas or wind power. We put every utility coal generator in the nation through a straightforward pass-fail economic test. We used publicly available data from USEPA, Department of Energy, and other sources to determine if each coal generator can remain competitive once retrofit and modernized. I'd now like to ask my colleague, Jeff Dayette, to discuss our methodology behind our test and what we found.
Thanks, Steve. Well, Steve just mentioned our analysis applied a straightforward pass-fail economic test on individual coal generating units all across the country. I would like to say up front, though, this was not a test of complying with EPA rules. Instead, it is more of a snapshot in time analysis, looking at a very specific set of pollution control technologies that we use, in essence, as a proxy to modernize the U.S. coal fleet. So we started by calculating each generator's operating costs, and for generators lacking any of four important air pollution control technologies that address some of the most harmful emissions from coal power generation today, we added the cost of installing those controls to that unit's operating costs. These controls included scrubbers for controlling sulfur dioxide, selective catalytic reduction, or SCR, to control for NOx, bag houses, which reduce particulate emissions, and activated carbon injection technology, or ACI, to cut mercury emissions. So, I'd also just point out that these technologies that we looked at are widely available today and are actually already in use in many of the best performing coal generators in the country. So a coal generator actually passes our test if, after being upgraded with modern pollution controls as needed, the power it produces was cheaper than the cost to operate a natural gas plant. If it was more expensive, then it failed our test and was listed as ripe for retirement. So this means, what I mean by ripe for retirement is that switching to cleaner energy sources like natural gas or renewables and or investing in energy efficiency would likely make more economic sense than spending billions of dollars to extend the life of an outdated generator. And therefore, we believe it should be considered at least for closure. So nationally, we found up to 353 coal generators failed our test and were determined to be economically vulnerable. That's as much as 59 gigawatts of generating capacity, or about 18% of the nation's coal fleet. These coal generators on our list are located in 31 states, mostly in the eastern half of the United States and concentrated in both the Southeast and the Midwest. Georgia tops the state list with more than 7.4 gigawatts of ripe for retirement capacity, followed in order by Alabama, Tennessee, Florida, and Michigan in the top five. In Georgia, Our analysis identified as many as 22 coal generators located at 7 coal-fired power plants as being ripe for retirement in our high case. And those facilities included Plant Crisp and Mitchell, both in the greater Albany area of the state, Kraft, which is near Savannah, Harley Branch, which is northeast of Macon, Georgia, Bowen, Plant Bowen and Hammond, both of which are northwest of Atlanta near the city of Rome, and Yates, which is in the city of Noonan, southwest of Atlanta. These generators on our list may no longer be economically viable if they're upgraded, in meaning that the electricity that they produce would cost more than the electricity generated by gas power plants and renewables in many cases. In fact, our analysis actually showed that the generators on our list at the plants at Kraft, Mitchell, and Crisp, as well as several of the oldest generators at Plant Yates, are actually economically vulnerable even before taking into account the cost of upgrading them with modern pollution controls. Like the rest of the right for retirement generators across the country, the generators that failed the economic test in Georgia are typically, they share some common characteristics. They're typically old. In the case of Georgia, they average about 43 years of age, but half of the 22 generators are older than 50 years, and they're dirty. More than three quarters, 77% of the generators on our list lack three or more of the pollution control technologies that we examined in the report, which I laid out at the beginning of my comments. All but one of the 22 generators on our list is owned by Georgia Power, which is a subsidiary, as most people know, of Southern Company. And Southern Company ranks as the power company with the most ripe for retirement coal capacity in the country, with about 15.7 gigawatts of outdated coal capacity across their four subsidiaries. The rest of the top five power companies in our list include the Tennessee Valley Authority, Duke Energy, American Electric Power, and First Energy. Yeah, whereas TVA, Duke, AEP, and First Energy have all made significant progress in determining a large number of generators as being ready for closure and actually setting firm schedules for many of their retirements, Southern Company has been a little less forthcoming. Southern Company has shifted some generation from coal to gas in response to the availability of low-cost natural gas over the past few years. So they are running some coal plants less and some gas plants more. They also recently announced the retirement of two of the generators at Harley Branch, scheduled for next year, and are starting to make some progress in ramping up energy efficiency investments. However, we believe that Southern Company has not shared the specifics of its plans for its remaining coal fleet adequately. And given the large number of economically vulnerable coal generators that we identified, for Southern Company, they will need to do really a lot of work with utility regulators to carefully consider whether ratepayers would actually be better off by retiring these old coal generators and boosting electricity generations from gas and renewable energy sources like wind, or investing in energy efficiency instead of retrofitting. So at this point, some of you may be asking, you know, can we actually retire this level of coal generation and still keep the lights on? Well, we did look at that in our analysis, and we believe the answer is yes. While it's not a trivial exercise and will, of course, require proper planning going forward, our analysis really found that all regions of the nation's electricity system, including the Southeast region, are really well prepared to continue providing reliable, affordable power while retiring and replacing coal capacity over a period of the next several years. And there are really several reasons why we feel that the system can readily handle so many coal retirements, including first, there is an abundance of excess generating capacity system-wide across the country. The North American Electric Reliability Corporation, or NERC, recently reported that the United States is projected to have about 145 gigawatts of excess generating capacity by 2014. That's above and beyond what is required to maintain a reliable grid. In the Southeast Electric Reliability Region, which is known as CERC, and which includes the state of Georgia, The NERC report found more than 30 gigawatts of excess capacity available. Thus, in the near term, we believe that significant coal capacity can be retired without actually needing to replace it with any new generation. Second, we found that there was a significant amount of underutilized natural gas capacity across the country. In the U.S., we have a fleet of natural gas combined cycle power plants about 220 gigawatts, and we found that these facilities actually operated at an average capacity factor of just 39% in 2010. So far less than what they are capable of producing power. So if we run those plants more often, that has the potential to immediately replace most of the retired coal generation projected under our high estimate in all regions of the country, including the Southeast. And third, we are seeing a significant increase in the deployment of renewable energy and energy efficiency across the country. There is an abundance of new renewable energy and efficiency that is projected to come online just in the next several years due just from existing state policies alone nationally, with much larger amounts of resource potential sort of yet to be tapped and waiting to be tapped, but needing more aggressive renewables and energy efficiency policies, and I would characterize Georgia as one of those states of needing that. But I would also point out that new investments in transmission are also allowing for low-cost renewables to travel longer distances. And so parts of the Southeast which may want to tap into resources in the Great Plains, for example, are now increasingly able to do so. Alabama Power, for example, recently announced plans to purchase wind power from Kansas, saying it was actually a lower cost option than generating the power themselves. In addition to these resources, it's important to note that long before any coal generator stops producing power, grid operators would work closely with generation and transmission providers to ensure that the electricity supplies will continue uninterrupted. So in addition to that, coal generations would not be retiring all at once, but would rather be shut down in an orderly manner over several years, which is consistent with regional reliability plans. Before I conclude, I'd like to also just talk a little bit about some of the environmental and public health findings from our report. Retiring some of Georgia's dirtiest coal capacity would actually substantially cut many harmful emissions, including significant amounts of sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, mercury, particulates, and other toxic emissions associated with coal generation. This, of course, would provide important benefits to public health and the environment, including fewer incidences of asthma, chronic respiratory disease, fewer premature deaths from lung and heart disease, and less neurological damage in children due to mercury emissions. In addition, coal-fired power plants are also the nation's largest single source of heat-trapping carbon dioxide emissions, which is the primary cause of climate change. Nationwide, shuttering the 100 gigawatts of coal generation that are either generators that are either ripe for retirement or already slated for closure, as Steve mentioned earlier, would reduce the electric power sector's annual carbon dioxide emissions by up to 16%. Depending on which resources actually replace that coal. In Georgia, closing the 22 generators at the 7 plants that we identified in the report would mean eliminating as much as 36.4 million tons of CO2 each year, which is the equivalent of taking as much as 5.4 million cars off the road. Now, before I turn it over to Ula, I just actually want to throw it back to my colleague, Steve Frankel, who is going to just give a very brief comment on the risks of over-reliance on natural gas and some top-level recommendations that we want to offer in the report.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. So while we found while our core test is based on comparing these coal generators to existing natural gas and new natural gas, and we found, of course, that there's ample natural gas capacity available out there to replace much of this uneconomic coal, we have some concerns around what that might mean. We do not recommend an unbridled rush to natural gas without fully considering some of the risks associated with doing so. We know that there's excess capacity in the natural gas generating fleet, and we think we should take advantage of that. The low price of natural gas is good for ratepayers and consumers. It's good for the U.S. economy, and so we want to take advantage of the affordability of natural gas. We also recognize that natural gas plants have a lot of operational flexibility. They can turn on and off and ramp up and down relatively quickly, and that provides an important level of flexibility to how the grid operates, particularly when it's paired with wind resources. But there are concerns around price volatility. We all know that natural gas prices have gone up and down dramatically over the last several years and several decades, in fact, and so it's hard to forecast the future price of natural gas. And of course, the more we rely on natural gas, the more pressure there'll be on prices. So there's potential risk there. Of course, we also know that natural gas is much cleaner than coal. It has dramatically lower sulfur dioxide and particulate emissions, no mercury emissions. And that's a tremendous benefit to public health. It's also beneficial from a climate perspective in terms of climate protection, but it's still a fossil fuel that has half the coal content of coal. And so from that perspective, in terms of a long-term climate strategy, a dramatic shift to natural gas that locks us into natural gas generation for many, many years going forward carries risks. So that said, with those caveats, what does this all mean in terms of what recommendations we have? We are not calling for the outright closure of all the right for retirement coal generators we identified in this study just because they failed our economic test. Every coal generator has to be considered on a case-by-case basis based on local factors, the impact on the grid, et cetera, and what other resources are available to replace it. Nor are we saying that those coal generators that passed our test will remain economic to run for many years in the future and therefore should be retrofit to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars or even billions of dollars. So our core recommendation is really that regulators, investors, and utilities should fully and fairly evaluate all the economic realities and pressures and considerations facing every coal generator that would likely need to be modernized. This careful consideration should determine whether ratepayers and shareholders would be better off by retrofitting that generator or retiring it. If a coal plant will be less economic to operate after installing pollution controls compared to cleaner, more affordable alternatives, then we'd recommend that that plant be retired and ratepayer dollars be invested instead in lower-cost, cleaner energy resources like natural gas, wind power, and energy efficiency technologies. We have a finite amount of capital and resources that we can invest in our energy future, and we think those resources should be targeted at the least-cost options that are best for consumers and are sustainable and more resilient and good for the environment as well. So we think these considerations are fully accounted for. That might suggest and lead utilities to choose to retire many of these older, inefficient coal plants rather than retrofit them. In terms of policy, at the state and federal level, there have been many state policies that have been supportive of accelerating a transition away from fossil fuels towards cleaner energy resources, such as renewable portfolio standards and energy efficiency standards. Those have helped create a marketplace for renewable energy and energy efficiency, and those have been a powerful tool. At the federal level, there have been incentives for clean energy resources like the production tax credit, which we think should be extended, as well as other policies that would help level the playing field so that clean energy resources can compete on par with fossil fuels. We also recognize that there are important public health and clean energy, public health and environmental protections that have been proposed, and we encourage the US EPA to finalize many of those rules. So with that, I'd like to stop and open the line. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to turn it back to Eula from SACE to talk about some of the strategies for what to do with the coal fleet in Georgia and what it means for those decisions that need to be made.
Great. Thank you, Steve, and thank you, Jeff. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is very pleased to be partnering with the Union of Concerned Scientists on the release of this important report. I'm going to talk briefly about a few more issues specific to getting coal-fired power plants retired here in Georgia. As many of you know, in this state, we are at a critical crossroads in determining our energy future, and it is fundamental to have independent analyses and thinking like this new report, to help shape decision making. We at SACE believe that Georgia Power is over-dependent on coal-fired power, and the findings in Ripe for Retirement bolster our concerns that ratepayers are shouldering an unfair bias that the utility has toward coal instead of alternative energy resources like wind, solar, and energy efficiency. The Public Service Commission in Georgia, which is charged with protecting ratepayers, has allowed gaps in its process that Georgia Power is able to exploit in order to maintain its pro-coal bias. As many of you know, last year Georgia Power went through a decertification process, and as Jeff mentioned, in this process they announced plans to retire two units at Plant Harley Branch. And within the last year, Plant McDonough has now come fully offline. While we applaud these developments, we cannot ignore the fact that additional coal retirements are necessary to protect ratepayers and the environment, particularly in light of the roughly 1,000 megawatts of natural gas the company has already secured to replace much of the coal capacity. We know the utility is working to analyze their best means of complying with impending EPA regulations, such as the mercury and air toxic standard, and this report helps drive the point home that retirements are a critical and economically advantageous piece of that compliance and often outweighs the cost of retrofitting to clean up specific offending pollutants. Next year, Georgia Power will undergo its integrated resource planning process, and this happens every 3 years. This process is a prime opportunity for the utility and the Georgia Public Service Commission to thoroughly vet the numerous alternative resource potentials available to the company. And perhaps more importantly, it's an opportunity to analyze the least cost resource options and do full cost analysis to determine what the impacts would be for ratepayers. The cost impacts to customers from keeping these old coal units online is too high in many cases, and we hope to see many of the units named in this report on their retirement list next year. Lastly, while the upcoming IRP process is a great opportunity to advance more coal retirement and increase alternative resources, many utility decisions happen during the off-IRP years. And currently, there's no standalone proceeding separate from the IRP in which Georgia Power would seek pre-approval to install pollution controls like scrubbers. The fundamental problem with this lack of a separate process is that the scope and quality of the review on least cost and alternative resource analyses is seriously inadequate and may not allow for full consideration of retirement options. While there is nothing that would prohibit the Commission from requiring a more robust process, it currently does not exist, and when Georgia Power wants to install expensive pollution controls, it doesn't have to ask for permission or make a robust case for why retiring or alternatives might be cheaper. They just spend the money and get approval later to pass the cost on to ratepayers. We need Georgia Public Service Commission to work more assertively to ensure that Georgia Power's energy planning truly benefits the people of the state and not just the pocketbook of the company. There are numerous ways in which clean energy and energy efficiency alternatives could be more transparently and thoroughly vetted in planning processes. We are hopeful that reports like this one today offer an opportunity to highlight the current inadequacies of our system and drive us to work harder to ensure more robust planning occurs in the interest of the ratepayers and the future health of our planet. Thank you very much. Back to Amelia.
Thank you, Ula. Operator, we're ready now to take reporter questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. One moment, please. Our first question comes from Heather Duncan from Macon Telecom. Your line is open.
The Macon Telegraph. Jeff, I just wanted to make sure I got something correct from your previous comments, that the CERC found that more than, was it 40 gigawatts of excess capacity are available in the southeast?
Yeah, so Heather, that's NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation.
Okay.
And their report found that there would be 30.4 gigawatts of excess capacity in the southeast region of CERC, which encompasses pretty much most of the southeast states except Florida.
That is currently or in what year?
In 2014.
In 2014. And Ulla, I could tell that your comments are written down. Is that something that you might be able to provide via email afterward?
Sure.
Thanks. That takes care of me.
Our next question comes from Mary Landers from Savannah Morning. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Mary Landers with the Savannah Morning News. I don't think I understand why Georgia Power isn't shutting down these plants if there's this economic case to be made for them. Can you help me out with that reasoning?
I'll take a stab at this. Is Jeff, and then maybe Ulla could provide some local context to that as well. Southern Company, as a regulated utility, can rate base the cost of pollution control technologies, meaning that they can get cost recovery at a guaranteed rate of return with very little risk to themselves as a company, placing more of the burden on their ratepayers or their consumers. And so, they're heavily invested in coal. They have been for decades, and I think would like to maintain that those facilities operating for as long as they possibly can. That's part of the reason why I think they haven't made the decision. Plus, we have seen in the past historically some volatility in natural gas prices, and as a result, there may be some concern about making a wholesale switch to natural gas, as Steve mentioned, is not something that we would like to see. There are some risks involved with doing that. What we found in the analysis is that that Georgia Power, like a lot of utilities across the country, could be investing in a diverse mix of cleaner alternatives and do so affordably. And so we're just encouraging them, calling upon them to actually carefully look at these facilities and to work with the Public Service Commission in Georgia to ensure that ratepayers aren't put on the hook for bad investments going forward.
Does the report detail what each plant needs to do to clean itself up? Like which of those pollution controls are needed at, say, Kraft, which is the one I'd be most interested in?
The report itself doesn't provide that level of specificity. I could look into that. In fact, I just taking a look here, the Kraft facility actually has none of the four pollution control technologies that we looked at. So they are lacking, scrubber, baghouse, mercury controls, and controls for NOx. As an old facility, having come online in the late 1950s and early 1960s, it's time for Kraft to take a careful look at, whether it makes sense to invest or retire those facilities. Ulla, would you add anything to that about the decision of Georgia Power?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I think we're seeing Georgia Power hedging their bets and really trying to maintain maximum flexibility by keeping many of these units alive, in some cases just fuel switching to natural gas as opposed to completely retiring. And we're seeing Alabama Power doing the same thing, running natural gas through a coal boiler rather than getting rid of the coal boiler and going to a cleaner operating natural gas facility. I think Jeff did a great job of explaining, exactly how those economic decisions fall. But many of these old coal plants are so old that they are completely depreciated depreciated for the utility. And so it's, in their minds, a better deal for them to keep them alive and retrofit them because of the way they can recover the money. So
one last question. What's their deadline for retrofitting?
Multiple EPA requirements that the utilities are currently considering. So the Mercury Air Toxic Standard is one that's coming down the line that they're going to need to comply with by 2015. And I know UCS has another expert on the line who can dive into more of the details, but there are, you know, multiple rules and regs that the utilities need to continuously determine whether or not they're going to be compliant with.
Sure. This is Rachel Cletus. I'm a senior economist at UCS. And I think what we're seeing is a lot of changing market and policy drivers at play here. So the power plant pollution standards are just one piece of them. There's also the fact that natural gas prices are low. We've seen the cost of renewables drop dramatically in recent years. We're seeing coal prices rising. So there are a number of reasons why utilities are looking at coal generation and seeing it becoming more and more uneconomic. There are various compliance deadlines that are at play with the power plant standards, but I think decisions are being made even now in advance of those compliance deadlines because of all these factors that are at play. So this is their moment to make the decision about what kinds of investments they want to go forward with over the next 5 years, say. And there are a lot of cleaner alternatives than coal, a lot of more cost-effective alternatives than coal.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. One moment, please. Again, if you have a question at this time, you may press star 1.
This is Steve Franco with UCS. I want to thank everyone for joining the call today. If you would like to get in touch with us, you can reach Lisa Nuremberger, our press secretary, out of our Washington, D.C. office at 202-331-6959, or Jennifer Renex at SACE at 865-235-1448. Thanks again for joining the call today, and we look forward to sharing more UCS reports with you in the future.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This concludes the program. You all may disconnect, and have a wonderful day.